This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're in Riverside, where the California School for the Deaf is having one hell of a football season. After recently suffering seven straight losing seasons, the Cubs are undefeated, and they're one game away from capturing the division championship for the first time in the school's 68-year history. So how did they get so good, and what's it like to play on an all-deaf football team? Here to talk about it is Thomas Fuller, a reporter at the New York Times who wrote about the team's winning streak, and Nancy Leibach-Amen, the superintendent of the California School for the Deaf in Riverside, who's joined by her American Sign Language interpreter, Mara Bowditch. Thank you all for being here.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Steve. Hello.
Nancy, let's start with you. Congratulations, first and foremost, to your school. How does it feel to be on your way to the finals this weekend?
Oh, thank you. Quite honestly, I have not had a decent night's sleep since last Friday, and I'll tell you why. I'm full of excitement. We are more than ready for this game on Saturday. It is a big day for the entire Riverside community.
Thomas, you're the San Francisco Bureau Chief. What made you hop in a car and travel all the way down to Riverside to cover this team, all the way down the 5?
I just love this story. You know, it's the holidays, and we need an uplifting story, and boy, is this an uplifting story. As you said, seven losing seasons, and teams would come to the School for the Deaf and, you know, sort of write them off and say, oh, this is going to be an easy win. And this year, it's not that they're undefeated, they're beating their opponents by tremendous margins. I mean, in the regular season, it was 642 to 156, if you add up all the points. So it's a massive, they're an amazing team. They're amazing kids. They're very physical. They're just great football players. And then added to that is, as a hearing person, when you're watching it, you're seeing how they're turning deafness into an advantage on the field. And it's just remarkable to watch.
Yeah, didn't they win a game over the Desert Christian Knights 84-12?
That's right.
84. They scored 84 points.
And it would have been a lot more lopsided, but the Cubs, the Riverside School for the Deaf, football team, showed mercy, and they put in their second string for the entire second half. So that score was a merciful score.
What's it like, Thomas, for people who have never been to a game where at least one of the teams does not hear, especially at home? Is it quieter? Is it, you know, are the crowds more visual? How are things? Explain that to an audience who may not know.
Well, there are two sides to that question. One is what you mentioned. When it's a home game, which it will be on Saturday, there's a crowd that includes many deaf people. There is the entire team, and all the coaches are deaf. And so there's no loudspeaker. There's no play-by-play. There's no national anthem before the game. It's a different feeling. You're there and you're watching much more intensely because that's what you're focused on. The team itself, the other side of the question, is how do they communicate amongst each other? And this is really impressive to watch. They don't need a huddle. They just walk up to the line, they turn to their coach. Their coach signs to them the play. And by the way, it's often coded signs. So even if you knew sign language, you wouldn't be able to decipher it unless you knew their codes. Mm. And then they're very efficient. And they're very, I would say, more efficient than their opponents. And one of the coaches that they played, matter of fact, that game that you mentioned, the opposing coach told me, I have never played against a team that communicates better than the California School for the Deaf Riverside.
How do you go, though, from so many losing seasons to we haven't lost one game, we've beaten the crap out of all these other teams that have come in? You know, going from the narrative that, you know, these teams are coming into the Riverside School for the Deaf to, to win an easy game to they're hammering us. How does that happen?
Well, this is a great group of kids. They have come up together. There's a core there that played together in middle school. They were undefeated in middle school. The star player is the quarterback. His dad is the coach. They are just a football family. They love football. And so this cohort, this particular cohort, is very talented. And you add that to this edge that they've developed, and it's this undefeated combination.
Nancy, do you have anything to add? I mean, without hearing, do your visual and other senses become more acute?
Yes. So I actually wanted to piggyback here. Thomas, in his article, mentioned that there was no play-by-play, right? There was no narrative over a loudspeaker, that was not provided. And so when I read that, I have to be honest, that hit me hard. And I'll speak to as to why. I never thought I needed that. Going to watch a game, that was something that never struck me. And deaf individuals that attend games will always, you know, if you miss something, they're going to look over at their neighbor and say, hey, what just happened? What happened? And so there's a ton of side conversation that occurs amongst the fans. So we ourselves are the loudspeaker, and we're giving that play-by-play throughout the game. So that really gave me a different vantage point, but I don't feel like I'm missing out. And in fact, I feel it's more intimate. The way that we do conduct that, right? That we're having those conversations within the audience and we're filling each other in on what's going on throughout the game. So I wanted to speak to that. I just think that's a salient point to mention here. And yes, to answer your question, they are more sharp than hearing people. No offense. It's just the truth here. You know, we're not able to hear. And so yes, our acuity, visually speaking, we're more alert. We're able to catch things peripherally throughout the entire game.
I would imagine that there are different echelons, I would say, you know, in hearing loss and in how a football player is able to communicate or perhaps, you know, the things that they can do with the coding and the communication, you know, like if a player was born without hearing, right? Or if a player lost hearing at some point but remembers hearing things, how much of a difference is there? And maybe you can speak a little bit of your own hearing loss as well, Nancy.
Sure. I was born deaf. And I'll tell you a story. I was in the grocery store. I was in line at the time. I think I was 3, maybe 4 years old. And I looked around and I thought, these people are so weird. Why are their mouths moving? Huh. Why are they doing that? What is that? This is not a joke.
Yeah.
This was my exposure. The point here is, people talk. I never heard of it,
yeah.
Pun intended. My parents are deaf. You could probably guess that there. But realizing that people do talk, and you know, I could talk if I wanted to, that never limited me from that opportunity. That said, now bringing it back to the question at hand, deaf kids that became, let's say that they have a hearing loss that has declined over the years. With those individuals, they have the ability to speak more often than not, but they have a sense of belonging, not with the hearing community, but with the deaf community because of the full access. Honestly, what it boils down to is access here. And so many hard of hearing people out there go to public schools, they're in the public school system, and they might catch 50% of the conversation. Could you imagine having a conversation where you miss 50% of it? That's frustrating. Like, hey, what was that? I missed that. And it's ongoing. And so that occurs with hard of hearing students very, very often. And when they join us here at a school for the deaf, they realize how incredible it is to have complete access. So here we have the academics, we have the socialization, we have extracurricular activities, we have sports. I mean, it's mind-blowing for these students. A lot of our hard of hearing students feel that way. And sadly, a lot of individuals out there view hard of hearing students as being really having most benefit in the public school system as opposed to us. And it's quite honestly the other way around.
Well, your school is the only public school, right, for the deaf in Southern California.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. We are, and I'm very proud to say that.
And only one of two in the entire state, right? The other school is in Northern California, right, in
yes.
Fremont.
Yes. California Department of Education has three state schools, all of them public schools. So we have the School for the Deaf in Northern California, Fremont, and then we have a School for the Blind as well in Fremont. Our School for the Deaf serves all students throughout Southern California, starting as north as Bakersfield, all the way down to Chula Vista.
Has the vocabulary changed over time when discussing the deaf community? I know we say low vision now more times than saying blind. Is deaf preferred over hearing impaired? How's language changed over the years?
Oh, my goodness. Hearing impaired is incredibly outdated, and it's very offensive. I will say that, just to caution you. I'm sure, you know, so I was born, and people use the term hearing loss. I'm thinking, I was born without hearing. I never lost it. I never had hearing to begin with. What is the point behind the term hearing loss? It doesn't make sense for someone like me. I was born, honestly, as Nancy, so I'd prefer to be seen as such. I'm Nancy, and I am deaf. The D is capitalized, and that defines all hearing levels. I think that would be more appropriate terminology, not even hearing loss, but hearing levels.
Thomas, are the hearing teams that come to play, are they respectful? What did you witness?
Well, you know, I was at the game on Friday evening on Catalina Island, and I was noticing that some people in the crowd on the opposing side were sort of making noises that were mimicking some of the noises that the deaf players were making. Mm. And so I think that answers your question. Over the years, as Nancy can tell you, over the years, teams have come to Riverside, and some of them have, many of them have been respectful, but some of them have not. And some of them have been, some of the coaches have been overheard saying, we can't lose to a deaf team, or, you know, this is going to be a walkover, this will be really easy. And I think that's what makes this story so moving, is that you have this group of boys who are just completely proving them wrong.
Obviously, the players can be affected by stuff like that too. I mean, they can't hear people mimicking them, but they know that there's that stigma, right?
Well, absolutely. And there's something else, which is that these boys have loved football since a very young age. And when they were very young, they didn't have outlets like they do now, the all-deaf team. So they would play on hearing teams. And I heard this from a number of players. And the coaches on those hearing teams would just talk at them. And they didn't understand what was being said. And they would be put at nose guard, because that was a position that didn't require too much communication. And they just never, it was very frustrating. And the word you hear again and again is that it was lonely. You were surrounded by people, but it was lonely because you couldn't communicate with them. Imagine those kids who grew up playing on these hearing teams, being frustrated, and now they're all together. Only deaf kids, only deaf coaches, communicating absolutely fluidly. You can imagine how galvanizing that is for a team, and how much they're inspired together, because finally they're together in a group where everyone is on the same page. They can understand each other. And I'll tell you what, if you watch communication with ASL, American Sign Language, it is faster than people speaking. It is a very efficient way of communicating.
Nancy, that sounds like it works well for the football team. What about in general, though, if we sort of zoom out, as it were? You know, do you think it's important for deaf students to be in an all deaf environment like your school creates? Because in school settings, we often hear about the importance of mixing kids with different abilities rather than separating them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Schools for the Deaf are the place for deaf kids. What you want is a kid to feel whole. That's the ultimate goal, especially nowadays in today's society. It is getting so convoluted. Kids need to feel good about themselves and their identity and understanding of that in academics. Bear in mind here, we offer both. We offer American Sign Language and we offer English. So we are a bilingual school. The language of instruction is American Sign Language, but we read and write in English, of course. We offer speech. We never dismiss that. We honestly offer everything so that these students build confidence academically speaking. That way, when it does, you know, come time to graduation, they're headed out to either a trade school or a college or university, they can interact with other people that are not deaf because their emotional well-being is there, that their confidence is there. Those that grew up in a public school, they may struggle academically speaking, and they might be angry at the end of that because of all of that strife. So that adversity leads to frustration later on in life. We want them to feel whole. And that's where a school for the deaf comes into place. What stands us apart from other schools, I think, is the language of instruction, American Sign Language. We practice inclusion here. That's what we practice. And there's a misconception thinking that we do stand alone on an island. We don't. It's the opposite. The opposite holds true. So, and I've heard this narrative time and time again, we invite these individuals to come and visit us here so that they can see it for themselves. And oftentimes what they had in mind is completely popped. That bubble is popped and they see us for what we are.
Well, I want to congratulate you on an amazing season. And I wish you the best of luck. The Division II Final Championship is this Saturday at the California School for the Deaf in Riverside's home field. Superintendent Nancy Leibach-Amen, thank you so much for coming on. Good luck. Good luck to you and your team. American Sign Language interpreter Mara Bowditch, who was interpreting for Nancy during this interview, was her voice. And Erica, thank you for holding the phone. Thomas Fuller from the New York Times, I want to thank you for your reporting as well.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having us here. Thank you again.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. In 2018, Democrats swept all seven congressional seats in Orange County, a GOP stronghold for decades. Well, 2 years later, Republicans won back some of those seats. But is there another shift in the cards in Orange County? The California Citizens Redistricting Commission released their draft plan earlier this month. And while nothing's finalized, if that draft sticks, three representatives from OC, two of them Republican, one of them a Democrat, might not live in their districts anymore. And Orange County may even lose one congressional seat altogether. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. He's here with KCRW's Orange County line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So first, remind us what Orange County's congressional delegation looks like right now.
Well, let's see. You have Mike Levin down in South Orange County, Democrat. Katie Porter, Democrat. Lou Correa, Democrat. Then you have Michelle Steele and Young Kim, first ever Korean-American congressional congresspeople who are women, both Republicans. Alan Lowenthal is interesting because his base, the Lowenthal family, has always been in Long Beach, but he represents a big chunk of Western Orange County, and he's a Democrat. And then there's like Linda Sanchez, like a tiny sliver, so she's kind of OC, but kind of not. So mostly Democrats, you know, in a place that historically was Republican.
Right. Geographically speaking, though, what would change about the districts in Orange County if this draft plan passes? Who does it favor?
Yeah, it's all these little carve-outs. It's very interesting. So, for instance, Alan Lowenthal would no longer be in Orange County. He'd be just Los Angeles County. Young Kim would lose what she currently represents right now in the Inland Empire, just small little pockets of, like, was it a Chino, or Riverside, San Bernardino counties. That'd be mostly Orange County. La Habra, which everyone always forgets about La Habra and Orange County, one of the few cities that have a 562 area code, that would be completely represented by Linda Sanchez. So all these little carvings, but that's the interesting point then. As it's then carved out, like Katie Porter, Michelle Steele, and Young Kim, the districts that they represent now, they would no longer live in those districts if this redistricting would happen.
All right, you mentioned Young Kim. Let's talk about Michelle Steele. She narrowly beat Harley Ruda last year. Would her district be more or less friendly to a GOP incumbent?
It would be less friendly. This is still one of the more Republican districts in Orange County. I mean, it's Huntington Beach. How could it not be? But this current district has Little Saigon, a long redoubt of Republican power that would be cleaved off from her and given to the district currently with Lou Correa, which is a very, very Democratic district. So Michelle Steele barely won. In this case, she could probably face a very good challenger in Harley Ruda, who won in 2018, beat the longtime incumbent Dana Rohrabacher, but which Michelle Steele beat in 2020.
And then Katie Porter, the Democrat, rising star in the Democratic Party, by the way. Her district, number 45, is Irvine and Tustin and Laguna Hills and parts of Anaheim. Is she in trouble if this new state district map holds?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is interesting with the district redistricting in California when it comes to congressional. It's supposed to be done by a bipartisan commission, but it really seems like they're doing it just to mess with Orange County. So, yeah, Michelle Steele, who cares about you? Boom, we're going to make it harder for you. Katie Porter, everyone loves Katie Porter in the Democratic Party. The Republicans absolutely despise her. Right now, she's mostly in Irvine and, you know, Laguna Beach as well. All of a sudden, she would get the really Republican parts of Orange County. You got Yorba Lindas, your Anaheim Hills, that whole area. It just turns into like this one huge incongruous blob because Yorba Linda has nothing to do with Orange County other than it's overpriced and really like drab suburban hell. But one's liberal and one's conservative.
Yeah, Yorba Linda, home to the Nixon Library, too, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So tea leaves here, Gustavo. Republicans are hoping to win back the House next year. Conventional wisdom says they have a really good shot at it. Will Orange County help or hurt them?
The interesting race, I think, will be with Katie Porter because Katie is beloved among her constituents, but if all of a sudden she no longer has those constituents, does she stay there? Does she try to run then against Mike Levin down in South Orange County? Because that's the interesting thing with Congress people. They don't have to live in their districts. They can live anywhere. And so Katie needs to be in a place where she's going to be beloved. Young Kim, that's going to be an interesting one. Reading the tea leaves, to use that cliche, I think Democrats still maintain their lead. And I would say, you know, Katie pulls it out, but Michelle Steele, she better start campaigning right now, especially if she's not going to have that Vietnamese vote.
So you're saying it's a wash, or at least Orange County doesn't help in Republicans trying to take over the House?
No. Like, and look, the Republican Party is going to pour so much money against Katie Porter, but they just don't have candidates. All the candidates that they've had, they have become the Democrats of years past, where they're putting up sacrificial lambs up against Katie Porter and some of these other people. So the Republicans might go all across the United States. I still say Democrats hold. The future for Democrats really goes through Orange County now, which is absolutely crazy thing to say, but it is what it is.
And this draft plan, I mean, do you expect to see any more changes to it, or is this done?
I'm sure both parties are just going to be clamoring. I mean, again, the Republicans do not want to lose Michelle Steele where she's at now, or make it as easy as possible. And same thing with the Democrats. But it's supposed to be a bipartisan committee that's not listening to anyone, but this is California politics, and you're always, especially now, you're just a text away from saying, hey, man, hook it up for the homies, you know?
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times and our aficionado down in OC. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
And as we know, Gustavo, of course, homie. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, it's been a bad couple of months for the noses of Carson and vicinity. Why is there still a stench there months later? Who's doing what to fix it, and who's affected by it? And the LA Auto Show is in full swing, back in person. How electric cars are fully juiced And what about the chip shortage and supply chain? Wednesday on the show, Paul Thomas Anderson, the director, talks about his new movie, Licorice Pizza, coming out this weekend. Hope you'll tune in. Grab the podcast anytime. KCRW.com/GLA, all our episodes there. Share your thoughts with us, too. Tell us how you're hanging in there and how we're doing as well. KCRW.com/GLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Toss, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all help piece the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time and your ears. Have a great night.